You're listening to an On The Move Media Co. production.
Well, you know, when you've been doing events for well over 40 years, and you've done just about everything you could possibly do, except the Olympic trials, it's on your radar to do it. So we had thought about doing a bid in 2020, you know, Atlanta got it. And so we were up there and we just, you know, got very involved with learning everything we could about the bidding process. And we had made a decision to bid for 2024. And really they only had two people that bid, Orlando and Chattanooga. There was a lot of work involved. It took some folks, John and two people on our staff, really over a year to get that bid together.
That was Betsy Hughes. This is Marnie Salop. Thanks for tuning into my podcast, Marnie on the Move. Each week, I will be inviting interesting, innovative movers and shakers to join me on the show and share their story. You will discover and hear from thought leaders, experts, influencers, and entrepreneurs from the worlds of wellness, sports, beauty, fitness, fashion, and more. Marnie on the Move will feature an eclectic mix of people I know, work with, and think are generally doing cool things. On each episode, I sync up with my guests about life, career, and training, and showcase their expertise and story. Hello, welcome, and welcome back to the Marnie on the Move podcast. I'm your host, Marnie Salop. Today on the podcast, I sync up with Betsy Hughes, co-owner of Track Shack, the Orlando-based running retailer and running event company responsible for spearheading the bid and bringing the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials to Orlando. Betsy has been in the running, retail, and event business and an avid runner for over four decades. Track Shack running events include the iconic Walt Disney World Marathon and Run Disney events, the Orlando Half Marathon, and one of the longest running women's running events, the Lady Track Shack 5K. Betsy takes me back to where it all began, her passion for running, her foray into retail and running event production, course measuring, and how she and her husband, John, grew this family-owned retail shop into a blossoming running brand. Betsy shares how her son, Chris, came on board in the retail business after college and how they thrived during the U.S. Olympic Marathon trials. We chat about how running culture and shoes have evolved over the decades, some of Betsy's go-to shoes, what events she's running these days, and the many Track Shack training programs and Track Shack Foundation. Betsy and I met through a gentleman named Jake Brooks, who I met while waiting to head over to the Hyperion House when I was in Orlando covering the U.S. Marathon trials. I noticed that Betsy was speaking on a couple panels, and I thought, she sounds so interesting, and I really wanted to meet her. And serendipitously, Jake happened to know her and connected us. So here we are, Betsy Hughes, Track Shack co-founder. Let's get into it. It is so wonderful, Betsy, to have you on the podcast today. You are such a pioneer and thought leader in the world of running for people around the globe. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. I'm excited to get to know you too, Marnie.
So talk to me about when you got involved with Track Shack, what the history is of this major brand that started as a retailer in Orlando.
I started running when I was 14 years old. There wasn't a lot for girls in junior high. And I would come home from school and I'd watch a show and I'd eat Ritz crackers and peanut butter. And I thought, there's got to be more to afternoons than this. So I joined the track team and there was one other girl. And everybody was very nice. Three of the guys on the team were in my homeroom. So we always went to school together. We saw them every day. And so they were very encouraging. So I'd had some issues. I had a lot of issues with my feet right away and shin splints. And back in the 70s, there weren't great shoes. And I did convince my dad to take me to spend probably $30 on a pair of shoes. And they didn't have ladies, so I think I got kids or maybe a small man's. And it was at a mall store. And at that store was John working part-time while he went to community college where he ran. So that was, I don't know what year that was, but I met him again when I started in high school and I went out for the cross country team, and you didn't really go out. Everybody was on it. There was no trial run. You know, they needed five people to score. But when I was a senior in high school, Track Shack opened by three businessmen. One was the manager of that mall store, not John, and two were silent partners. One was a banker and one was a sportscaster. And they had this dream of opening a specialty running store, which really didn't exist in 1977. There were just a few around the country. And of course, there was no internet, so nobody really knew who was doing what unless they read a running magazine. So back then, there was Racing South, Running Times, and of course, Runner's World. And I got a part-time job after track practice at this new store, Track Shack, that my dad's like, that's never going to make it. And it, you know, it didn't for a long time. But I went away to college after I graduated. John had become a third partner in the business. So he now ran Track Shack, literally, and was part owner. And those guys, the other two guys, Terry and Tracy, were silent partners, which was great. But I helped him even back then when I was in college with the books and things. So fast forward, I didn't run in college. I tried. I ended up with foot surgery. Started out at Alabama, finished up at University of Florida with a journalism degree, and came home and we got married. That was in 1983. So we weren't going to live together, you know, we were going to just get married. And we did 2 weeks after I graduated from college. A week later, his two silent partners said, hey, we want to sell the business. And we're like, oh, wow. Took us 3 months to find money from various banks to buy them out. But we did. We thought, we love this. We're going for it. And so that was in 1983. So that was 41 years ago. There wasn't a lot of business. There were a couple races in town, which we started getting more involved with. And now, 47 years later, we produce all those events that did take place then. We have three that are that old.
It sounds like it was very organic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you just, sounds like you've always done what you loved. I mean, organic in the sense that it just all came naturally for you, but obviously it takes a lot of work.
The part that didn't come naturally was probably the business part. We didn't have a manual to tell us how to do sales tax or, you know, all the different things a business owner has to do. And so I learned on the fly big time. I used to, back then, remember there weren't computers. So I hand wrote every check. I did the taxes, the payroll taxes for the couple employees that we had back then, on little coupons. And we did inventory on a big spreadsheet, physical inventory. So yeah, things have changed a bit.
My father had a retail business, and I remember like going to work with him when I was like 12, and like my grandmother used to do the books. So, and like they used to take like all the hang tags, like the tickets, and enter it into the books.
Yeah.
Those were
the
days.
You know, yeah. Then you saw what it was like. It's hard to even think back that far anymore because things have evolved so much. But, you know, we loved running. We had a passion, not just for running. John and I loved people. And we had so many friends in the community that supported us and loved on us and just helped us get through those early days.
And you're based in Orlando, and that's kind of, I mean, I know you're there now.
Yeah, Orlando. Yes, John and I grew up in Winter Park, which is just a little past Orlando, but it's just a smaller community. But then Track Shack was in, when it first opened, they chose a little strip mall in not a great section of town back then. And a year and a half later, we moved across the street to an old house. And then in 1996, we found a bigger building 300 yards down the street. And so we've been there since. That's the building. If you came to the trials, people saw it, the group runs and all. But that, our area here now has, it's like the place in Orlando to go to is that Mills 50 area where we have the store. We lucked out a little bit.
Perhaps you built it. Like, if you build it, they make
them. That's nice. Well, we used to say that about our business because everybody always said, when are you going to open over here? When are you going to open in this town and this town? And we're like, we love our business and we are super, super busy. We didn't feel like we needed to be in another town or, you know, 5 miles down the street with another building. And I think we made the right decision.
I think there's different ways to build a business, right? Like, you know, you could open 50 doors around the nation, or you can do what you guys did, which is like really doing like a deeper vertical dive into, you know, you had this amazing retail store. You started to connect with the community locally. I mean, you've grown the business from a retail store to an event company and not-for-profit. Like, you do a lot of giving back to youth organizations. And I mean, there's just so much. So talk to me a little bit about how you went from the retailer to the events and, yeah, and all the other things that you do.
Yeah, so, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, the running boom hadn't really started. And we knew that to bring customers in, we needed to put more races on. So we started getting more and more involved in the races that were in existence, but also starting to produce some of our own events. And also just creating an event company, a timing company. We actually started scoring, you would think it's very old school, but we actually used a computer in 1983, the fall of 83, and one of our local runners was an IT genius, and he wrote a program so that we could score the events electronically, because you have to remember how we used to do it. Everybody filled out a registration form. If they had a charge card, you used the old charge card slider to take the money, and then there were a lot of checks involved. Everybody did checks back then. But Mike, who just retired, created a program for timing, and we were probably one of the first companies that actually scored events using the computer. Very different than it used to be. We used to have a tear-off tag, and we'd collect those, and then we'd plug the numbers into the program, and there was so much more involved than that, because you still had to use a handheld timer for the backup, and I don't know how old you are, Marnie, but prior to that,
52.
Oh my God, I would have thought you were 32. You look so young.
I love you.
Oh my gosh, I never would have guessed that.
71.
But everybody used to, wow, okay. So you were born before the store started. Yeah. That's good. Everybody would fill out these index cards with their name, their sex, and their age. And we would file those in the appropriate age group boxes. It was way old school, but that's what we did for a long time. And then the timing went off. That became a business in itself. And 37 years ago, we hired two people, Tom and Natalie. They that's still amazing. Work for us. And they helped us take the road racing business to a new level. And in 1990, we incorporated that as a separate business because it was very different than retail. But the two companies were very much connected and still are.
And you also are an Track Shack also plays an integral role in the Walt Disney World Marathon. So how did you get involved in that race? And what's your role now with the race?
So in the late 80s, we were producing a 5 mile event at the what's now called Disney Springs. I can't remember what it was called prior to that. I think it was Disney Village. It was a bunch of shops outside of the theme parks. And that race went on maybe just for 2 or 3 years, but Disney was growing and growing, and it's hard to get roadway there to run an event. And in the early 90s, John's like, we need to do a marathon at Disney. And because, again, back then there weren't really half marathons. Everybody did a marathon if they ran distance. So John started talking to the marketing department at Disney, and there was one woman who we still see from time to time. Her name was Ginger. She believed in us. And we started having more and more conversations. and brought Fred LeBeau of New York City Marathon to a lunch with some of the executives at Disney. And little by little, they really started believing it. And in 1994, we hosted the first Disney World Marathon. So it was before Run Disney existed, and we worked with their marketing team. And then, of course, we had our business, our running business, so we produced it for them. We did the registration. We did everything, paper registration, believe it or not. We had 8,000 people register the first year.
That's a lot for sort of in those days, right?
Yeah. We only had about, I don't remember the number exactly, like 6,500, I think, that actually started. But when they were registering for this event, remember, paper forms. It was so crazy how we used to do it.
Technology and just all these things have evolved so much. I mean, you know, from, you know, the old days to the internet to social media. So I know it's kind of interesting, though, that you can still talk about like how you did that back then and to how you've grown and evolved. And Track Shack came onto my radar just when I was getting organized to come to Orlando to cover the U.S. Marathon Olympic Trials. I thought it was so interesting that, you know, the committee for the Olympics and the Games chose, I think, I don't know how, even really officially how it works, but maybe I should ask you, how did this all come into fruition and come into play?
Well, you know, when you've been doing events for well over 40 years and you've done just about everything you could possibly do except the Olympic trials, it's on your radar to do it. So we had thought about doing a bid in 2020, you know, Atlanta got it. And so we were up there and we just, you know, got very involved with learning everything we could about the bidding process. And we had made a decision to bid for 2024. And really they only had two people that bid, Orlando and Chattanooga. Is that right, Chattanooga? There was a lot of work involved. It took some folks, John and two people on our staff, really over a year to get that bid together. We worked with the Greater Orlando Sports Commission. A couple of those folks helped with some of like the hotel numbers and security details. There's so much involved with the bid process. You can understand why not many people do it. And it's incredibly expensive to get the bid. USA Track and Field and the Olympic Committee don't put in any funds. So you got to know that you can get sponsorships and make sure you have the money in order to do it. And thankfully, we got the bid and it did work out. It was a great trials. You were there, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure you were there that day as well. So all the athletes got one of these corksicles.
I got to really get engaged in the community, go to the, you know, some of the media events and hang out. And I interviewed a bunch of athletes and friends, and it was amazing. I mean, I think, you know, is it a one-time thing? Like, you won't do it again in Orlando? Is it like every city gets an opportunity, and do they do it twice in one city? Or,
well, I can probably see why you wouldn't do it twice because of what's involved. And we know how to put a race on and we're really good at it. But that was the hardest thing we ever did. It was the hardest thing we ever put our event team through. It was something that we wanted to do and we did it for the love of the sport, but it was tough. And we had people that very day say, hey, you need to bid for the next one. This was great. And it was like, oh, I'm so glad we did a good job, but we're not doing it again.
Is that like what you say about a marathon? Like, oh, it was hard. No.
Yeah. You know, it is funny because as a former marathoner and a mom, people used to say that. You used to say that after a marathon, but you also say it after you give birth to kids.
I said it after a marathon. I don't have kids.
Yeah. And people used to say, running a marathon's harder than having a kid. And I'm like, you're a guy, so you can't say that. And if you do have kids, typically that's a lot harder.
So yeah. No, I wish to say I would never do another marathon. I signed up for one.
What'd you sign up for?
I did New York City in 2019. So I'm like a 70.3 triathlete and a half marathoner. I love those half distance. But you know, living in New York City, and being part of the running community, I wanted to try the marathon, but I wasn't really ready. And my ultimate sort of, you know, reason for doing any marathon was ultimately to qualify for Boston. Like, it wasn't about, I don't know why, that's just in my mind. I'm not even from Boston, like, I'm from New York City, but I just felt like I like to roll like that. You know, I want to do the hardest thing on the planet without doing any of the easy stuff. So I thought, all right, like, I was interviewing New York Roadrunners on the podcast. It was like back in like 2018, 2019, and I had a great relationship with them. And at the time, the CEO asked me if I wanted to do the marathon. And I was like, yes. And it was July. And so I didn't realize, like, I probably should have been training a lot longer, but I said yes, because it's the opportunity of a lifetime to do the New York City Marathon. And in 2019, it was like the beginning of like when I wanted to do it. And so I did it, and it was the hardest thing I ever did. I was also like sick during the race, but I finished. Ooh. And I was like, I didn't even almost missed my medal. I was so delirious. I just kept running, and I knew that my partner was outside the park with the car. And so I just wanted to get to the car because I knew there was food. And it was like, I was so psyched that I finished. I didn't think I was going to finish. But I knew that I would never not finish. But in my mind, I was like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done, with like bronchitis. And I got through the finish line. I must have eaten like so much food and passed out. And then I woke up the next day and I signed up for the New Jersey Marathon. And my whole family will tell you that in the car, I swore I hated the marathon. I was never doing another one again. It was the worst experience of my life. And then I signed up for another one. And then it got canceled because of the pandemic.
Right.
And I took it as a sign. So I signed up now. I got my wits back. So I'm doing New York City.
Yeah. But, you know, you did one of the best marathons you could have done. You know, I mean, you can see why you'd want to do another one. My mom started running when I was running in high school. And she was in her, she was probably just about 50. And she'd raised six kids. She came to all my meets and fell in love with the sport. And because she was from New York, she said, one day I'm going to do New York City Marathon. Well, that was her fourth marathon, I think. And it was when she was right before she turned 60 years old. So it was after she did the Disney Marathon. So it was in the mid 90s. And that was her last marathon. But we had a magazine back then. We did everything. If it was running, we did it all. So I was on the press truck for the marathon. That was like so exciting. Because I went to New York with my mom, and she did it, and she did it under 5 hours. And that's before chip timing. And she's 95 years old now.
That's amazing. Is she still running?
Well, until about a year ago, she would go walk a few miles, a few times a week. She has congestive heart failure, and she has to use the walker now and can't breathe that well. So, but she still gets out and walks around the block with the caregiver.
That's amazing. I mean, movement is so important, right? It's like,
it's
whatever you can
incredibly
do,
important.
Just do it, you know? You've done New York City Marathon.
So we were up there working the expo one year, and I was not training for a marathon, but we did decide to run it and had the opportunity to have an entry. And I didn't finish it. It was like a training run. I did like 16, and it was at a good stopping point. I wasn't prepared for 26. I feel really bad saying that because I don't usually quit things.
But you weren't committed to finishing. Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't committed.
Feeling it out. So would you ever come back and do it now?
So my body's not going to let me do a marathon again. The miles after almost 50 years, I get out there. I did 3.5 today. And that was good.
You know, like, I think that's great. You know, wherever you're at in your running journey.
Shout out to our partners at HVMN and Ketone IQ. Ketone IQ is fuel for your brain. These exogenous ketones give you a clean energy boost without sugar or caffeine. I'm a big fan of exogenous ketones for training, racing, and everyday health. They increase your energy, your focus, and metabolic flexibility. They're also the brain's preferred fuel source over glucose. I've been using HVMN's Ketone IQ individual shots on training runs and in races. I take one 30 minutes before a run or ride. I feel it 20 minutes into my session, and then I drink a second bottle after an hour, and so on. One of my favorite things about Ketone IQ is that it's drinkable, which is key when it comes to exogenous ketones. They are truly an asset to whatever nutrition plan you're following. You don't have to give up your carbs. They work independently. Imagine you're in a traffic jam. Suddenly, a new lane opens up. This is the exogenous ketones lane. HVMN and Ketone IQ work with top Olympic athletes like Des Linden and Michael Andrews, Ironman world champion Sam Laidlow, and top world tour cycling team, Team Visma Lisa Bike. It's time to level up your athletic performance and everyday health by adding HVMN's Ketone IQ to your workouts and daily routine. Visit hvmn.com/Marnie for 30% off your first subscription order. Now, back to our conversation.
You know, I just asked that question because I'm sure that the Olympic trials like brought a ton of business to Orlando and to Track Shack, and also like opened up doors for you to produce other events. So despite a lot of the hard work that you did, what are some of the opportunities that came from the challenges in this event that you produce?
That's a good way to put it. And we see everything as a challenge and an opportunity. And we are so happy that we produced the trials. And we feel really good about the job we did, the people we brought in and our team. We know everybody had an amazing time. And because we have the store as well, our son Chris is the director of the retail operation. And he had a big challenge. He said, we're gonna sell more Olympic trials apparel than anyone ever has. And we did. We probably sold, I think it was four times what anybody ever sold. He produced, because we were so busy doing the event. He had activations with every brand out there, Wednesday morning, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday morning, Friday night. It just kept going on and on and on.
Yeah.
As you know, because of Jake, we were helping at the Hyperion house. Jake used to work with us. And of course now he works with Brooks because his last name is Brooks. It's perfect.
That's so funny.
But no, it did. It opened the door for other opportunities, but the awareness of Track Shack as who we are, I mean,
a major player in the running scene.
Yeah. And you know, we feel like we always have been, but we don't like pat ourselves on the back. But we know a lot of people know of Track Shack now that did not know before. And I'm really pleased with that. We're just so happy that we had this opportunity and that our staff lived through it and enjoyed it. And it was something that you can never not see in your mind again. We're all still dreaming about it.
I think it's pretty amazing that a family-owned business that started out as a retailer has grown into this national and even global recognized brand. That's like a huge story. I mean, to me, and it's such a good story because you hear about all these corporate public companies that are doing, you know, great work, but it's not a story. Like, that's okay, great. You know, but this has like a lot of legs, and you know, even, you know, with the Disney marathon and the Disney half marathon that you guys produced, I mean, it started with 8,000 people, and now how many people are signing up and registering for this race, like even this year?
Well, we have four Run Disney events at Walt Disney World, and we now have two at Disneyland again. There were more before the pandemic. But the January event, we had, I think, 65,000 participants in the four events. And since then, we've had a Disneyland event and the Prince's Half Marathon. And next month is the springtime 10 miler. That's a big part of our business now, the whole Run Disney entity. We still are in charge of, we do registration, we do timing, we do the course, and because that changes all the time because of the construction.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about what it takes to put a course together. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, Tom, one of the folks that I told you about that have been, Tom's been with us for 37 years. He used to create the courses for our D Disney events and for our local events. You have to work with the
Okay.
municipalities. You have to find out what you're
Right.
allowed to do. And for instance, with Disney, some of it's on property, some of it's in Osceola County. And then events that are in Orlando are different than events in Winter Park. Every municipality is different. Then you want to find the courses like for the
Yeah.
trials with no brick. Everybody was afraid, oh, downtown Orlando, it's all going to be brick. Well, we brought in the big guns to help us with the course for the trials. We brought in David Katz, who does many, many Olympic events, course-wise, etc. And we knew we needed to have it a loop course. And so it was the trials course was
Yes.
amazing. The Disney courses change all the time. So I mean, it's tough. Our team has a really tough time. And the hardest part is you have to measure it in the middle of the
Oh.
night. Because you can't have cars on
Right.
the road. And plus you're going through the theme park, so it has to be in the middle of the night. I used to be a course measurer. I measured three Olympic trials marathon courses with a group of women. We did the women's courses, the women's trials. Back then it was separate. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it was silly that it was separate, but.
I didn't even think about that, you know, like that's so interesting because I just assumed that it was all together. But then, you know, look at what Iron Man's doing, separating the men and the women now.
Isn't that awful? I'm so sorry.
I'm not a fan. As a media person, it's like, and I love Iron Man, but it's so hard because I have to decide, like, you know, I can't go to every. You know, I have, as a media
Right.
person, I want to go to the World Championships, and I'm not the New York Times, so I can't go to both Kona and Nice, although I wish I could. But, like, you know, which one is gonna be better? You know, like right now it's looking like the men's, but I
Right.
would love to cover the women's. I don't know. I don't know why. I understand why they did
We
that, but.
have, oh yeah, I do too. I mean, they want to have more participants and they need the space, but we have married couples here in town that they both qualify and they can't necessarily afford to go twice.
That with everything that is positive, there's also something negative. So you can't really always win, I think, you know. So I understand where Iron Man is, what they're trying to do, you know, especially with Hawaii, right? Like they had too many people and it overwhelmed Kona. But at the same time, you know,
It's true.
and I'm sure that they would say that. But so I didn't realize that the Olympic trials were also at one point just women or just men, like exclusively.
Yeah. So in 1984, the first trials in Olympia, when
Yes.
Joni won, that was the first one, and that was just
Okay.
ladies. And then I measured, and I was part of the next three trials courses. And after that, they put them together again because of the
Yeah.
expense. It's just like with
Yeah.
Kona. I mean, you have to make a decision. Where are you
Yeah.
going to go? And yeah, it's so much better now. So much
So
better
you're
to have it
not doing that
together.
anymore, though, personally, like measuring courses.
I'll measure if I
Yeah.
have to, but no, I think I was the first woman measurer that measured 9 months pregnant.
Wow.
Yeah. There used to be a little measuring pamphlet that went out, Measurement News or something. I remember I was on that once. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard if you're trying to raise a family or even work because you're out
Yeah.
all night. If especially if you're doing a marathon, that's usually 3 nights in a row. So you can't function the next day. I can't. I need sleep.
What are some of the other races that you organize? You said the Orlando Half sounds like a great race. Yeah.
It's great. We've done that for well, this will be our 47th year, and that's a great event. We have a 5K with it as well. We also produce, we started 30 years ago, we started a corporate 5K event. And so our corporate 5K is going to be May 9th. Before the pandemic, we got up to 18,000 runners. We do it on a Thursday night in downtown Orlando. Now we're gonna shoot for 13,000 this year. It's been growing since the pandemic because, of course, it went to virtual the 1 year. But that's one of our really exciting 5Ks because that's an event where corporations encourage their employees to walk or run, and for many, it's their first
Right.
5K. So there's seeds being planted that evening. And we've seen so many people come from that event over the years to start as a half or a full marathoner. And that's just, you know, that's really what it's right. all about. It's keeping people on the roads and healthy. And if you're healthy, you're happy. I mean, we're very lucky that we're in the sport we're in. We're really, really fortunate.
You know, in terms of like the weather, because when I was in Orlando, it was a little bit cooler, the temperatures, right? Then like when I was in Miami and did the half marathon the weekend before, how does the weather affect in the race planning and directing all of those things in Orlando?
Well, weather's really, really important, but we know that there's climate change and we know it's warmer, but our races down in the South here all start around 7 a.m. What we did at the trials, that was for the TV. We would have never wanted to start that late in the day. They should have been finished by then. So we're lucky. We're so lucky it was cooler during the trials. Yeah, so no, we do have to think about the weather, and we're really careful with the wet bulb test. You know, we're always, my husband's like, he plays weatherman for every event. And we're just, you know, we let people know if it's really, really hot, sometimes the course is cut shorter. We tell everyone, like at the Disney events, don't overdress, dress like it's 15 degrees warmer so that you don't overdress. We do have to teach people because it is warm here. And, you know, you wear sunscreen if you're running a marathon, but you do it from the nose down. Don't do it up here. It's going to get in your eyes. I mean, lots of things to teach
people.
Yeah,
no, I mean, even in New York this weekend, you know, it was 50 degrees for the half marathon, and I overdressed, somebody who's been running for 20 years. I don't know what, like, what it is. I need a weather report. Like, I'm going to do it, the weather report.
Yeah.
Like, I mean.
Yeah, you have to text my husband. Text John next time you do a race,
what
and he'll tell you, he'll say, oh, my gosh, I have the funniest story. I told you my mom was a runner. John was her coach. So my husband coached her, and she used to go to England and rent rooms from people's homes in an area called Milton Keynes because they had a great running program. And she would train in England. And once a week, she'd spend the big bucks and call John, and John would give her her running schedule for the week. But when I was going through some of her things the other day, I found a file marked running. And I wish I had it. I should go get it and show it to you. She has a chart for every degree what she wears.
Oh my God.
Whether it's 80 degrees, 70, 60, down to 40 degrees. Whether it's shorts, what kind of long sleeve, maybe a short sleeve over it. It's so funny.
Well, I think that's amazing. I mean, you're welcome to share that like as a snapshot, and I can put it in like as an over, like what, an overlay or something. I mean, that's so cool because, I mean, even I use Training Peaks for all my training, and I started doing this, but I don't consistently do it enough, so then it doesn't work, right? But, like, I am going to start writing down the temperature, what I wore, what I should have worn. I mean, I gave away a wool jersey. I mean, like, I don't know why I wore wool. I'm just always cold, you know? In the morning, I was freezing, and I have so much crap. I could have, like, put it on and thrown it out and donated it, you know, race morning, which is what I always tell other people to do. I give a lot of advice I don't follow.
Yeah. Our brains don't work race day a lot of times. Yeah. We did London Marathon one year, and it was, gosh, I was probably 30. And the tech products weren't out really yet for shirts. And so I had a long sleeve cotton shirt on, and underneath was a short sleeve. And it was snowing at the start. And then it got warm. So I ditched my long sleeve shirt, which was probably soaking wet at that point. And then it got cold again. And I was so miserably cold. So I'm so glad we have good products now. And wool is a good product. You should have worn a light wool shirt.
I did,
would have been perfect.
But by mile two, I started to get... Well, I was also wearing a jacket.
Yeah, no jacket. Not
I know,
50
but
degrees.
It was, you know, in my mind, I was going to freeze and, you know, it would be awful. And I thought, you know, the other thing I thought about and didn't think about was that I was running in zone three. Normally, when I run, I'm in zone two if I'm going to wear a wool shirt and jacket, right? So if it's 50 degrees and you're doing zone two, like, sure, you can get away with that. But, I mean, I was, like, pushing hard. I was just going for it. I just wanted to get out of Brooklyn and over the bridge and into Times Square. I was so excited. So I, by mile two, I was sweating. By mile four, I gave away like a really nice wool Tracksmith shirt. And then I got to mile eight and my friend was there and I gave her my jacket and I ran the rest of the race in a tank top. But I mean, note to self, 50 degrees is 70 by mile two.
Yep. Yeah. Always. Always. Or have a throwaway. We used to cut garbage bags. Did you ever do that trick?
In the rain, because before I had the heat sheets, I would like cut a hole for my head in a garbage bag and go to a race. Yep. Yeah.
All right, just dropping in here to give a shout out to our partners at UCAN. Are you tired of the spike and crash and GI distress that comes with sugar-based sports nutrition? It's time to give UCAN a try. UCAN utilizes steady-release carbs instead of sugar, so you don't feel the highs and lows in energy. It's been years since I've been able to use gels until I discovered UCAN Edge Energy Gels. When you're out training and racing for hours day after day, it's nice to have smart fueling options to boost your performance. Plus, they taste great, are the right consistency, and you don't need to chase them with water. My favorite flavor is pineapple. Also, UCAN's award-winning Edge Energy Gels last longer than other gels, less for you to carry. Top U.S. triathletes Olympian Katie Zafaris and Tim O'Donnell, along with marathon runners Emily Sisson, Sarah Hall, Emma Bates, Kira D'Amato, all rely on UCAN to fuel their training and recovery. Level up your race and training nutrition with UCAN. Go to ucan.co/Marnie to redeem your free, exclusive Edge sample pack. All you pay is shipping. And to save 20% off any UCAN products, head over to ucan.co and use our code Marnie. Now, back to our conversation.
But, I mean, in Orlando, it's lots hot. Like, what did I do in Miami? I mean, I'm just obsessed with the weather. I don't know. I look at the weather every day, and it determines what workout I'm doing. And, yeah. So I have...
Well, weather's important, and some people are really affected by it. And it is key to know, especially race day, what the weather's going to be like. We have our 10K, our Winter Park Road Race 10K this Saturday, and it's going to rain today, and it's supposed to rain Friday. And I'm very happy about that because that brings cooler temperatures. So right now it says it's 48 at the start, and I'm hoping that doesn't change this week because that would be great.
That's
for our
10K. That's amazing that you have that weather, because like when you go further south, like to Miami, it's like super hot, like at this time of year. Yeah.
We have good weather usually till about probably the beginning of May. And you know, we have training programs, marathon training programs that are year round. You wouldn't believe when they start. The new season starts in June every year, and at 4 and 5 a.m. it's disgusting here in Florida and Orlando. Ugh, the humidity is so bad. But we run in all temperatures. You just don't have an option if you live
here. Sure. And then beyond like the races that you organize and run, literally and figuratively, right? Run and run. You also have a blog. You have, you know, all kinds of content. You've got a big running community. Talk to me about some of the other things you do at Track Shack.
So we have, I started to tell you a minute ago about our training programs. We started those probably like the late 80s, we started a marathon training program, you know, because half marathons weren't really happening yet. So we have 2 6-month marathon training programs every year, and people join them. We have paid coaches, and then we have group leaders. And this year we have about 300 people in our program, and they have an opportunity to meet 3 times a week. And weekends are long runs, and we have group leaders, and the group leaders are amazing. So they send them the training program for that week. We have support people, which means they put out water and Gatorade. So you can't do it just with paid staff. You always, always, always need volunteers, whether it's an event or a program. And then during the year, we have 4 10-week sessions where we have track programs. And we have 3 coaches, so you do your magic mile and you find out who's your coach for those 10 weeks. We also have something called Zero to Fit, and we have beginning running programs. And we've done these for years and years. We have paid coaches, and like this morning, I got the cutest picture. Lorraine had the first session for the new 10-week program, and she had 15 first-timers come out to the program. I mean, that's planting seeds. That's getting people feeling good about themselves that they can come out in public and start a run program and know it's okay to walk some because they're moving forward, and we have very encouraging coaches. We do foam rolling. We haven't done it in a while, but sometimes yoga at the store. We have something called Ask the Expert, where at least once a month we have a physical therapist come into the store on a Saturday to see people for free. You know, our vendors are great. We often have a vendor on a Saturday set up at the store. And, you know, that's great for customers. And it's just for the awareness. Like Puma is one of our newer brands. And, you know, people don't think about that as a running shoe, but that's starting to get more popular.
Let's talk about shoes for a second. Because you mentioned shoes and the evolution of running and like what it was like in the 70s and now how we're seeing Puma again as a running brand. So again, right? Yeah. Because they were one of the original shoes that people would run in. And talk to me about Puma since we're talking about Puma.
Yeah. So in the 80s, at some point, I can't remember when, but Arthur Lydiard came and stayed with us. He was like a world famous coach. And he was a Puma guy. And he believed that shoes, I don't know why this popped into my head, should be shaped like bananas because your foot is curved like a banana. Isn't that weird? I just thought of that. But okay, so that's my Puma story.
I just think it's so interesting. Like, you know, you've been in the retail business and the footwear business since you started Track Shack. So how have you seen shoes evolve and the mindset behind shoes, right? Because it's not just like the actual design over the decades.
Oh, it's really crazy. Our first shoe wall probably had, and one of them was a tennis shoe, probably had 9 shoes on it. Our shoe wall now has probably 150 styles on it. The hardest part about that is they all come in multiple colors. That's the hardest part of having a running store these days. But, you know, we've always made an effort to do an evaluation for every customer, to measure their feet and spend time knowing what they're doing in the shoes, whether they're running, walking, working. We've done that from day one, and we still do it. So the only thing that's really changed is that a lot of technology is thrown into the mix now. People buy these very expensive programs where you stand in a circle and it measures your foot and it tells you what kind of foot you have. I'm sorry, those don't work. We still do it old school because we've tried the technology. And the most important thing is to visualize everything with your own eyes and to measure every foot. You can't rely on a machine to do that. You know, we've tried everything over the years because we wanted to be the best at what we did. And one thing that John and I are really proud of with our store and our event company too, most of our staff's full-time staff, and this is how they made their living. So they're getting a salary. They're not getting commission on every shoe or every insole they take off a wall. They're selling a shoe that works for that customer. And if that customer may need an insole, certainly they probably need a good pair of socks. It's not a pushy type of business that we have. And they get health insurance. They get disability insurance. We do everything just like a real business. And we do the same with our event company. But for us, and I think that's why we were successful, we were there for the customer, and we still are to this day. So when you come into the store on a Saturday, it's going to be busy. And we do a sign-in. We have an electronic sign-in. But when you are waited on, that employee is waiting on you, not 3 other people, not juggling all this. It's all about the customer. And yeah, shoes have changed drastically. I have some old magazines that one of them has this Nike ad, and it says, I think it was the LD1000 or something. And it says, this will last you 3,000 miles. Well, you know, we're lucky to get 400 now out of a shoe. Yeah, and there's just so many great options.
Do you have like a personal shoe quiver that you run in, or can you not mention brands because it would be kind of like not cool? Or
No. I can mention brands. I've done everything over the year. I used to have an Etonic shoe that I loved. It turned all my socks blue, but that was okay. But now I'm in a Brooks, and not because of Jake, but the Brooks Glycerin GTS, And I do use an insole, but I mean, back in the day, we all wore orthotics. We didn't need those most of the time. So this is just a Curex zero drop insole, just gives you a little extra oomph in the shoe. But my husband wears Ultras. He's a big zero drop fan, and that doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't work for me. We carry Hokas. They don't work for me. I believe a foot has to bend to be healthy, but we sell a lot of Hokas, so not everybody is the same belief as me. But we sell everything that we think as a store, a single-owned family store. We sell what works for our customers.
Yeah.
Not, you know, not what's being advertised necessarily.
But you must get to try a lot of shoes too, right? Because you get them in like before, you know, right when they're dropping to the public.
Yep, yep. And you know, with my issues over the years with my feet, I don't stray very much. And if I'm given a pair of shoes by a vendor, I, you know, I'll try it on in the store, but if I don't like it and I know it's not good for me, it'll go to an employee or we'll figure something out. So yeah, the vendors are nice. They're very, very, accommodating. It wasn't always like that, but you know, they are really good about having you try shoes out. We even have some pickleball shoes. And so that's amazing, isn't it?
When I was at TRE, I saw that all the running shoe brands and companies are making pickleball shoes because it's a huge, huge industry.
Yeah, they are. And it is a huge industry. I don't think it's anything like running. And we just bring a couple in, but we have a store that sells tennis shoes down the street and they sell pickleball shoes. And if we don't have it, we just tell them what size to buy because we've measured them and done the evaluation and we send them to the other store because you can't carry everything. We're really good at running and walking. That's what we do. But because we all like pickleball too, we brought in a few.
Which ones did you bring in?
So we brought in Asics because they were one of the first companies to bring one out. Saucony, and then the On, the Roger shoe, but that's not really very techy. It's just good looking. I wish I could wear that. It's so cute, but that hurts my foot. And New Balance I know has some, but we haven't brought those in.
Interesting. I have not tried. I grew up playing tennis. I love tennis. I don't play anymore because now I'm really focused on running and triathlon, and I'm afraid like one wrong move and that's the end of my running because I might twist my ankle or whatever. Mm-hmm. I can see like all the tried and true trusted brands creating this new shoe.
Yeah, so it's interesting about pickleball shoes because if you back up maybe 15 years ago, zero drop became a thing. And that was the biggest change we'd ever had in the running industry, in the shoe world. So you have these, all of a sudden the world is talking about stack heights. Is it a 10 millimeter drop, 12, 8, 6? And of course, then the book came out about barefoot running and everybody wanted to run in Vibram 5 fingers. And the doctor said, yeah, go for it, because they were making a fortune surgically correcting everybody's issues after they ran in a shoe that wasn't a running shoe. And we never carried that shoe. We waited for our tried and true brands, like you said, to come out with shoes that were made for running, but zero drop. And so we never wanted to get into the game of getting people injured when we knew that wasn't right. But we love zero drop as long as it's a good shoe for the right person.
So were the shoes in the 70s not zero drop? Because they were.
That's right. Some of them were, and people don't remember that. We have a museum at the store, so I can show people, we had zero drop. This is what we wore. Probably why I got injured all the time.
In my mind, I was thinking, I remember running, to me, was like this no-frills sport. Nobody used nutrition or hydration. Like, that was, like, really a negative. No. Like, if you were not cool. People wore these like no drop shoes. At least that's what I thought they were because they didn't have any. They were basically almost barefoot.
Yeah, Asics had most of the shoes back then that people would run marathons in. And we have a few at the store. They're totally zero drop, no insole, nothing. The first Nike shoes had a little bit of a heel rise. But yeah, it's just evolved so much. And people were actually sort of pissed, that's a terrible word, but they weren't real happy with us that we weren't bringing in the Vibram 5 fingers because everybody seemed to want to try this new running shoe. It wasn't a running shoe. So we're so fortunate that we have these researchers now and these design teams at the vendors that study and watch runners over and over again, and they're figuring out what's best for people. And we have so many options now when someone comes in the store. And you know, there's not a shoe for everybody, but you can almost always make it work if you have to, by tying it different or an insole if really necessary.
Yeah, there weren't even shoes for women back in the day, right? Like women were, I think now, like just technology has come such a long way. I mean, I still feel like that.
And socks
too.
Socks were horrible back then. We never wore socks because they were just heavy cotton things. And now, of course, we have great socks.
I need to learn more about socks, a lot more.
I'll help you.
You know, and in addition, Track Shack has a youth foundation. Tell me a little bit about the Track Shack Youth Foundation and all that you're doing to inspire kids to run.
So, I'd love to. I have two things then. I'll tell you about the foundation and I'll tell you about the Smile Mile. When we started owning our own events and creating our own events locally, we wanted the money to go back to the community. So it took a few years, but in 1994, we were able to put together a 501c3 that we call the Track Shack Foundation. It's now called the Track Shack Youth Foundation. And the proceeds from our events that we were producing went to the foundation. And the foundation is run by a volunteer board. And they get together four times a year, and grants, you know, are requested from various schools and different running organizations, but our whole focus was on children. And so quarterly now, they take money that we've given them from our events, and they are able to distribute those grants to various clubs and schools and even like camps, anything that's focused on children and youth athletics. And because we are the for-profit company that's giving the foundation money for their foundation, we can't sit on the board. So we don't make those decisions. We learned the hard way through the IRS that you couldn't do that.
So you started a separate company.
So our foundation's in its 32nd year, and it's really awesome. Kara Goucher did a program with our foundation the night before the trials, and it was for the young ladies that run, and it was great. We had a little panel of teenagers, and Wazelle sponsored it. It was really awesome. And then just last Saturday, we produced the Smile Mile that we've done for almost 40 years. And it's for kids age 5 through 11. And the 6 through 11 girls and boys all run a mile, and they run together. So we start with the 11-year-old boys, the 11-year-old girls, on down to the 5-year-old boys and girls. And then we do a fun run for the babies, for the little ones. And we get about, this year we had just under 1,500 kids, and it's just the most fun day. And when I went out for my run this morning, I ran into this lady. I see her almost every day walking her son in a stroller, and he's a little bit older. And so we were talking this morning, it's pitch black outside. I said, well, how old is your guy? And she said, he's 5. And I said, oh, that's great. And then she told me he did the Smile Mile last week. And I have never really spoken to her, but I see her every single day. So that was so fun to find out he did the Smile Mile.
Amazing. So you have people but you also, you know, you have this incredible local community, but for some of your races, you have people that are coming, runners that are coming from across the nation, around the world. I mean, I'm sure Disney attracts people from Run Disney is around the globe.
Disney does our Winter Park Road Race and our Orlando Half Marathon. They do attract people from outside the state. And we don't do a whole lot of advertising, but our website is really, really good. And we do a ton of social media, as you know. And so people find out, oh, you know, I'm going to go to Disney. So let me see what races are in town. And so we get people that way, too. They're just in town for spring break or whatever, and they'll find Track Shack.
And then you guys had such great partners for the trials. I actually connected with Brightline. So I love Brightline. Like, do you get a lot of people from all different areas in Florida now?
Well, you know, it's brand new. It really just opened. And so it only goes from the airport to Fort Lauderdale, and little by little they're adding stops. So I've never been on it.
Well, I will tell you that I am obsessed with it because my parents live in West Palm in Delray, and I did that race in Miami, and I don't love driving in Florida for so many reasons.
I don't blame you.
So when my mom was like, oh, you should just take Brightline. Actually, it was my sister who had done it. And I took it last year, not just this year. And I loved it because it was like, it's like the jitney of the Hamptons, right? Like you get on, it's nice, luxurious. They have good snacks. You know, I did the VIP thing. And so this year I teamed up with them on my podcast. And I mean, I just really traveled a lot, like from Miami to Delray to Orlando, back to Delray. I really liked it. Like,
I've heard really good things about it. Our registration platform group we use is out of Miami, Haku, and they do, we use them for all our events, and Run Disney uses them. And they used to all rent, they would rent a van for every Disney event and bring the team up, and now they all take Brightline because they can work the whole time.
It's amazing.
And with the Wi-Fi, and they love it.
They also, yeah, they have great Wi-Fi. They have good snacks. And they also did a special set. Like, I guess they added a train to Miami so that people could get there to come early for the race.
I wish they would come to Tallahassee, go to Tallahassee, because that's where our kids live and our granddaughter. And there's nothing to Tallahassee. You know, we raised our kids in the business, and we don't open on Sundays. We still don't after all these years. So that's very unique for someone in our field, our industry. Our son loved it so much that after college, I was thinking he was going to law school, and he said, no, I'm coming home to run the business. Well, it took a few years, but he now manages the whole retail side of the business, and it's wonderful. He's doing a great job. But we're grandparents.
How many kids do you have?
Just two.
And how many grandchildren?
Just one. She's six, and she is busy.
Is she running yet?
Not really, although she, you know, because they live out of town. Right, they live in Tallahassee, but we'll get her to some kids run soon, hopefully.
You have run this business. You've been through momhood and raising children, and you're back full on in the business, or have you ever not been full on in the business?
John and I have always been full on in the business. When our kids were in school, though, you know, we made a pact. We sent our kids to public school, and I was there every day to pick them up. So they never had to be latchkey kids. But because I do the books, the payroll, the insurance, everything paper-wise, I did that at home for years. I'd only work in the mornings when the kids were in school. So, yeah, it changed a lot with the onset of technology and the internet, and as the kids grew up, we thought we'd slow down. We just are busier than we've ever been.
Is there anything coming in the future in the pipeline, like new with Track Shack beyond what you're already doing?
I think Chris has some ideas with the retail. And then with the events, they just keep evolving, really. It's really exciting to see how people are still loving running and walking. And we don't really call anything a race anymore. I don't know if you noticed that when I was talking. We say events because we want to encourage everyone to participate.
Is that like across the community or across the world of running? And I didn't get the memo, or is it just you guys just call them events?
So I think you see the race word a lot. And I probably use it sometimes, but honestly, you know, people race, there's probably 20-30% of our participants are racing. The rest of them are participating. And if that's keeping them healthy and running and walking, then we're all for it. Only one more thing I should talk to you about. We have one of the oldest women's only events in the United States. The Lady Track Shack 5K started in 1978, and we still do it every year. It's for women only. We get anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 women that walk and run.
Amazing.
And it's just been an amazing event that's evolved in various ways over the years.
I think it's fun too. Like, there's so much power, like doing a race with all women or an event.
Yeah. I like that power. I like